Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The man whose intelligence we have the privilege of tapping each week is Gordon Chang. He has been our duty expert on matters involving Asia, both what's happening there and its implications for what is likely to happen here. Gordon is the author of two best-selling books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. He is a columnist for The Daily Beast. He frequently appears at Fox News and, as I say, with regularity here. We're always delighted to have him. Gordon, welcome back.
Well, I'm always delighted to be on your air, Frank, so thank you very much.
Good. Listen, the story of this unfolding saga between President Trump and Xi Jinping of China with respect to specifically the tariff war, as it's come to be called, is continuing to escalate. And I wanted to get your thoughts, Gordon, on the current situation and the effort that apparently is being made by the president's Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, to parlay with the Vice Premier of China. Talk about what's going on at the moment and what you think is in prospect now.
The most important thing is that this week, President Trump announced the imposition of tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese goods, a 10% tariff starting September 24th, moving to a 25% tariff the first day of next year. The Chinese have said that they won't attend talks with the United States if Trump imposed the tariffs. I'm sure that they will do so. Also, the Chinese have threatened to not sell components to companies manufacturing U.S. products. Also, I think that that's a hollow threat in the sense that even if they did that, they'd hurt themselves much more than they'd hurt the United States. Because China has prospered over four decades of the so-called reform era because it's made itself a reliable member of global supply chains. And China is now eroding that sense of reliability. So essentially, we've got a China right now that is threatening all sorts of things, but really can't carry through. And Frank, this really leads us to believe that this is a great week for the United States. You know, the Chinese threatened, President Trump called their bluffs, and now China doesn't really know what to do.
And I guess what you're getting at, Gordon, is that they're running out of tariffs to impose on U.S. imports because there are so much fewer of them than there are of Chinese exports to the United States. Is that right?
Well, that certainly is right. Last year, we sold $130 billion worth of goods to the Chinese. We purchased $505 billion. That left us with a trade deficit, which is a record, of $375.6 billion. So, you know, at this particular time, we have so many more goods that we can tariff than the Chinese can. And that's why Beijing has been searching for alternate means to impose costs on the United States. And it's really having a difficult time doing that. Got to remember that last year, 88.9% of China's overall merchandise trade surplus related to sales to the United States. That means an overwhelming dependence on the American market. We're the bigger economy, the far bigger economy. We don't depend on selling things to China. China depends on selling things to us. We hold all the high cards in a trade war, Frank. And let me emphasize, the only way that we could lose this so-called trade war is if President Trump caves into the Chinese. In other words, that he's bluffed into submission. I don't think we have a president who's going to be bluffed anytime soon. And that's really good news for the United States.
And yet, Gordon, as I mentioned, there seem to be those in his administration, among them the Treasury Secretary, who appear desperate to try to de-escalate this, and if that amounts to, you know, capitulation to the Chinese bluffs, it would seem, so be it. Is that how you read it?
I certainly read it that way. You know, of course, in any administration, you have a division of opinion on critical issues, as there is on this issue of dealing with China. You know, there have been a number of times where senior administration officials, including the Treasury Secretary, have tried to come to terms with China. And I can understand that. That's within decades of American policy towards Beijing. But we got to remember that we cannot have an enduring deal with China. We saw that last year with the Commerce Secretary's preliminary deal with China. It fell apart almost immediately. So right now, we're at a point where even if there is some sort of an accommodation that we reach with Beijing, it's just not going to last. We've got to understand what's going on inside of China right now, and that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, is in no mood to come to terms and to talk in good faith with the Trump administration.
I wanted to come back to something you said a moment ago, Gordon, because it seems to me to be at the heart, really, of this larger, well, economic war, I think, we're seeing waged against us by China, to which President Trump is now responding in some measure. And that is this idea of a reliable supply chain. And of course, the whole construct of China as a partner, China as a friend, if not an ally, China as a reliable member of the international community with whom we can have in this sort of great globalist undertaking reliable relations is at the core, isn't it, of this idea that we can depend upon them to supply the raw materials, the finished products, the advanced technology even that we require for a whole host of applications, including some of our military systems, it seems. It ain't necessarily so, I take it, is the bottom line as far as you're concerned, Gordon Chang.
Frank, this is a critical point. You know, we got to remember that last decade in this one, China threatened Japanese and South Korean companies because they had larger geopolitical aims. And now we have seen those South Koreans and the Japanese start to move their supply chains out of China into Southeast Asia. We're going to have to do the same thing because starting in June of this year, Xi Jinping has been threatening to, quote unquote, punch back against the United States, targeting U.S. companies. A lot of Chinese officials have been very concerned about that because they know that once China starts to do that, the American companies will do what the Japanese and the South Koreans have done. And indeed, over the last several months, we have seen Beijing target American companies, not giving them licenses, harassing them in minor ways. There have been a number of threats against Apple this year, including a couple of days ago. So really what we're seeing right now is China basically cracking the eggs that really were the golden ones for China. And so this is an important development. And remember, Frank, regardless of the Chinese attitudes on these things, we should be helping our friends with trade, not with a country that is threatening us.
This is an incredibly important point. Gordon, we're going to pause for a second, and you've been very gracious to agree to stay with us. I do want to talk a little bit more about what the Chinese are up to with the Russians and also the latest on what's happening on the Korean Peninsula. We'll be right back with much more with Gordon Chang right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang is still with us, I'm very pleased to say. We have an opportunity to explore a bit further what's going on in China at the moment, or more to the point, in Russia, with help from the Chinese. Gordon, as you know, the largest war games since the Cold War are underway in the east of Russia, with substantial numbers of Chinese troops participating. What is so striking about this is the sheer magnitude of these operations involving, we're told, some 300,000 troops. They are also apparently being presided over, at least part of them, by Vladimir Putin personally. And they also, we're told, involve simulated nuclear attacks against the United States. What do you make of, A, the nature of these exercises, and B, the fact that it seems as though they are further cementing a strategic alliance between Russia and Communist China?
This is an important point you make, Frank, because, you know, a lot of people say China and Russia will never form an enduring partnership. You know, that's a question for decades down the road. But right now, we're seeing their two militaries cooperate across the board. This Vostok 18 exercise is just a dramatic symbolism of that. And indeed, this exercise is intended to deter a land invasion of Asia. Well, that's directed against the United States, thinking that we would invade. But we've also seen the Chinese and the Russian militaries 2 years ago in 2016 practice what they called joint island seizing missions, quote unquote, in the South China Sea. And we also know that Russian military doctrine is to use nuclear weapons offensively. Putin has been talking about this many times in public, especially since September 2014. I'm sure the Chinese have in their own doctrine, although they say they have a no first use policy, I'm sure that they have a contemplation of going nuke first. And there are a number of indications of that. So this is extraordinarily dangerous. And it just underlines the fact that the United States needs to understand that Moscow and Beijing are forming that enduring partnership that you talked about.
You know, I had an opportunity last night to speak to a fairly senior U.S. military officer who has been specializing for some time now in what's afoot with the Chinese. And I asked the question, I think I've discussed it a bit with you in the past, Gordon, but I'd like to sort of get your current thinking of it. What Putin is making of all of this? It always has seemed to me as though it is an absolutely predictable endpoint of the trajectory that China is on, that it will simply expropriate large parts of Russia in due course, and that Putin is sort of presiding like Louis the 15th over incipient disaster. The French king famously said, "Après moi, le déluge," you know, after me will come the flood. The response that I got, I thought, was fascinating. This general said, well, he believes that Putin has simply calculated that China is going to win in its contest with the United States, and he wants to be on the winning side, and he will simply accept such terms as are required with the Chinese to that end. What is your current reading on that, Gordon?
That certainly is a reasonable interpretation of the way Putin is moving. I think that, you know, in terms of short term, in other words, this month, maybe next year, Putin realizes he needs Beijing because he has an economy which is fragile. And so right now, Putin is trying to make an accommodation with the Chinese. Of course, he is worried about Beijing's territorial designs over Siberia, but that's a concern which is well down the road in his mind. He's much more interested in what happens this week. And I actually think that as we look at the Chinese and the Russians, yes, we can always be concerned about the historical differences between these two countries. But nonetheless, we don't have to be worried about what happens at the latter part of the century. We've got to be concerned what's happening right now. And the reality is that we see closer and closer economic relations between the Chinese and the Russians, and we see deepening military cooperation. So it's incumbent upon us to look at today. And by the way, this is important because, you know, we've had a succession of American presidents, both Republicans and Democrats, who have talked about managing American decline. Well, that is absolutely the wrong thing. And the one thing that's great about President Trump is that he absolutely rejects that theory. He does believe in American strength.
And is determined to rebuild it, much to his credit. Speaking of the president, he was complimented today by Kim Jong-un for having helped stabilize the Korean Peninsula. This comment was made in the midst of the latest summit meeting between Kim and his South Korean counterpart, Moon Jae-in. Give us your current reading on what is going on between the Koreas, and specifically the kind of stability that seems to be emerging as a result of, well, what I can only describe as the appeasement of the North, the empowering, the legitimation, the propping up of that Stalinist regime by our so-called South Korean allies.
Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, is, as you note, in Pyongyang right now. And this is the third summit that Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in have held this year. What both of those leaders want is to unify the Korean peninsula. And they're talking essentially about a confederation where you have one country, two governments. They also, of course, want to end the Korean War. And Moon wants to shovel as much money as he possibly can into the coffers of Kim Jong-un. This is not a good situation. President Trump has allowed this to occur. And I think that the American president needs to pivot. We'd had a really good policy with regard to North Korea through, let's say, the middle of May, where we had our maximum pressure campaign. Since then, President Trump has decided to change, giving the North Koreans a one-shot opportunity to do the right thing. We've seen right now that Kim Jong-un is not stopping his ballistic missile and nuclear weapons programs. And so I think the United States needs to actually start to go and apply that pressure against the North Koreans again. And the reason why this is so critical is it's not just North Korea. You know, we have Secretary of State Pompeo saying, look, there's going to be new rules on dealing business with the Iranians. Well, no one in the world is going to pay attention to U.S. sanctions on Iran unless we start enforcing the sanctions on North Korea. And for the last couple months, we really haven't been doing that, Frank.
Let me ask you about one particularly egregious example of what I understand is kind of an increasingly brazen breaching of the sanctions regime by President Moon of South Korea. Gordon, is it your understanding, as it is mine, that billions of dollars worth of equipment and other materiel has been transferred to North Korea by the South Korean government under the rubric of this so-called liaison office in the DMZ?
Yes, well, there is actually reporting from Yonhap News Agency, which is the South Korean semi-official news outlet, that the South Korean government transferred 4 billion won to North Korea in connection with the establishment and opening of that liaison office. When you calculate it, it turns out to something like $3.5 million or so. Certainly an excessive amount. We also know, Frank, that in previous summits between South Korean and North Korean leaders, there's been a transfer of lots of money. So, for instance, for the first summit between Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il, there was about $400 million that the South Koreans gave the North, and that was all under the table. We don't know how much money Moon Jae-in has given Kim, but it's probably much more than the $3.5 million that they're admitting to.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to have that clarified because I was given the impression that it was vastly larger than that. But whatever it is, it does seem to be a breach of faith with the U.S. and a further worrying sign of what South Korea has in mind. And Gordon, to the extent that this has been explained at all, this so-called confederation of two governments ruling over a somehow united peninsula. What's your understanding of how on earth that would work? As a practical matter, it certainly seems as though it's a formula for the open-ended perpetuation of North Korea's, as I say, megalomaniacal government with all of the horrors that it inflicts on its own people and presumably an ability to extend its influence even further into South Korea as well. Is that right?
Yeah, it's certainly right, Frank. It's not only the perpetuation of North Korea's horrific regime, but it's also the intimidation of the South. We know that Moon Jae-in is not a firm believer of South Korean democracy. He tried to remove the concept of liberal from the notion of liberal democracy. And fortunately, he was thwarted in connection to amend the South Korean constitution. But they are changing the South Korean textbooks on this. They're also removing references in those textbooks to South Korea being the only legitimate government of the Korean nation. We know that Moon Jae-in has been removing barbed wire fences and observation posts along the demilitarized zone, which separates the two Koreas. Moon wants to reduce substantially the size of the South Korean army and to reduce the terms of conscription from 21 to 18 months. All of these reduce South Korea's ability to defend itself against a North Korean attack. And while no one really thinks the North Koreans are going to engage in a full-scale attack like they did in June 1950, nonetheless, reducing defenses allows the North Koreans to intimidate the South Koreans. And that's exactly what will happen under a confederation scheme.
Yeah, intimidation seems to be the least of it, Gordon, to me. And the cumulative effect of undermining South Korean security and the will perhaps even to resist the pressures that the North will be bringing to bear conjures up the image of a stability of a kind that's pretty awful, both for the people of South Korea, who I have the feeling, and you've certainly confirmed this in our previous conversations, don't have much of an appetite for all of this, but also for American forces that are there on the Korean Peninsula for the purposes of trying to prevent this kind of assault, either of the kinetic kind or of a more insidious and longer-term subversive kind, against our friends and allies in South Korea. Gordon, I appreciate having an extended conversation with you today. I look forward to doing so again next week. Thank you for your time. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the high privilege of being each week, by our friend and colleague, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, indeed, Kevin Freeman. I believe he is one of the country's leading lights on matters involving economic warfare, the subject of much of his professional work. You can find at globaleconomicwarfare.com and a forthcoming television production called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin is the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. I commend both of those to you, as well as his terrific blog. Kevin Freeman, welcome back. As always, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
I wanted to pick up on a conversation I've just had with Gordon Chang about one of the things that is coming to light as a result of President Trump's efforts really to, well, counterattack, I guess one might say, in the economic war that China has been waging against us for some time, as you've been pointing out. Notably, the question of our reliance on a supply chain from China, not only involving vastly larger imports than we export to them, but also a vehicle for financing, both through such purchases and through financial instruments that they denominate in dollars as well, resulting in our financing, Kevin Freeman, aircraft carriers, the aggression that the Chinese are engaged in the South China Sea, and much, much more. Talk us through what are the stakes in getting right our pushback against the Chinese and this sort of larger globalist agenda.
Well, Frank, it goes back to the late 1990s. It goes back to the Clinton administration, and it's a mantra we speak all the time. What we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. In the late 1990s, the Clinton administration saw markets and opportunity in China, and we opened up. We became globalist. They didn't. They were publishing the book Unrestricted Warfare, and they were looking at every domain as a domain of warfare, whether it's our financial markets. And if they issue the largest IPO in history, which was Alibaba, and we warned against, they took our money, our capital, billions of dollars, and they've used it to buy up Silicon Valley, and it's under their control. And what we got in exchange was a Cayman Islands corporation that has a right to have some of the cash flow from Alibaba.
A pretty non-transparent arrangement at that, no less.
Without any shareholder rights, without the ability to say, hey, I own stake in this, all the shareholders want you to do this, it doesn't matter. It's what the Chinese government says. We see that with Google. We see that in every area, financial markets, and they're very intelligent. They've gone in and said, all right, what in the supply chain is absolutely critical for the U.S. military, and they've underpriced in those areas. And we say, oh, it's a bargain. Let's go buy this. And so, you know, we find that whether it's the computer systems that have been infiltrated or whether it is the chips that we run our fighter jets on or whatever, they have gone in and looked at all of it.
and not least rare earth minerals. And this creates a condition in which we are seeing a yawning vulnerability. The president is trying through this technique of tariffs to, again, try to exert leverage on the Chinese to mend their ways. Not much evidence that's having the desired effect as far as the Chinese are concerned, though Gordon argues fairly strongly, Kevin Freeman, that it is compounding some of the significant problems the Chinese economy is having, that this sort of tariff war, as it's called, is underway. You have also called attention to the possibility that the Chinese may retaliate in a non-tariff form, perhaps even by taking down our stock market. In a piece that you've recently written about the next crash, you forecast that this is a distinct possibility. Tell us what you think is in the offing there.
Well, there's some simple truths. One is the Chinese have a massive cyber capability, and there was an article written in Harvard Business Review that finally recognized something we've been saying for a decade, is that our markets are vulnerable to a cyber attack, and that could create a financial crisis. But they also know how to manipulate the markets themselves, and they know how to take advantage of trading activity and so forth. They're very, very good at it. And the one who would disagree as to this possibility, oh, well, China, of course, doesn't want our stock market to crash. That would hurt them financially. And indeed, it would. But the Chinese have a very long-term view, just like a George Soros and others have a very long-term view. And they wrote about this. A single man-made stock market crash is a weapon that they use. And they mentioned it again recently. You start these trade activities, we might just crash your stock market. They know that a stock market crash today would have an impact on the November elections, probably a severe one, throw the bums out, which would mean the Democrat takeover and President Trump wouldn't have time to worry about trade wars. He would be just fighting for his life against impeachment hearings. So, yes, they're aware of this, whether they use that weapon now, whether they use it in 2 years before the presidential election, or whether they never use it at all because of the blowback. It can't be ruled out as a serious possibility.
And Kevin, to what extent does the possibility that the U.S. might retaliate against the Chinese stock market constitute a deterrent? Is that long view such that they would be unaffected or at least consider this to be a very advantageous trade-off?
Well, first off, you would have to recognize that that's what happened. And secondly, to retaliate, you would have to convince the American people that what you were doing was above board and right, because half the country at least would believe that Donald Trump caused the stock market crash. They would believe that the trade war caused it. In fact, there's in the academic circles, it's circulating now the idea that a trade war could be the trigger that causes this market crash and ruins everybody, and we can blame Donald Trump. So half of America's political intelligentsia would be arguing that Trump caused it, it's his fault. But yes, of course we could retaliate against the Chinese stock market if we wanted to, and if our market crashes, their market will not permanently hold up, but they have a very long view, and they may be willing to take that pain for the long-term gain.
They certainly have had us in their sights for a long time, and I think they anticipate that the full realization of their effort to supplant the United States as the dominant power of the world may be decades off in terms of coming to full fruition. But these are steps along the trail that could be extraordinarily harmful to us in the short term and net-net benefit them. Let me ask you one other thing, if I can, Kevin Freeman. We had a piece come across the wires this week that caught my eye, and I wondered what you make of it. Evidently, there was a very large so-called Bitcoin wallet that became active in trading. Someone who owned, as I understand it, something like $750 million worth of Bitcoins has begun selling them off. What's going on there, and what might it mean for that particular cryptocurrency, or more generally, the sort of evolution of such, you know, blockchain currencies in the future?
Well, Frank, it was, you know, number one, we don't know who owns this wallet. That's one of the aspects of cyber currencies, cryptocurrencies, is that you don't know who the owner is. And that's a benefit and it's a detriment. It did. It woke up and all of a sudden started selling off into the market, causing a flash crash. And we have these flash crashes in Bitcoin prices fairly regularly, and people, some people say it's a buying opportunity, others show it as instability in the system. The point I take away from it is that there is no cryptocurrency that is currently stable enough to serve as the world's currency. A lot of people hope that happens. A lot of people think it may come at some point in the future. But the reality of it is a reasonably small amount of trading, $100 million, was able to move the markets. $100 million is tiny in global currency markets. It's a fraction of nothing. And so the idea that you have this volatile bouncing around of Bitcoin, it says, number one, that this cannot serve as our global monetary system, at least not in that form. It's just not stable enough. Number two, the anonymity. We don't know who was behind it or why they were behind it. It could be someone that's trying to profit from this and trying to manipulate the currency. It could be, you know, it could have been a rogue hacker that stuck trading code into the wallet that forced that to happen. It's just not stable enough. It's an exciting technology. It has lots of potential promise, but Venezuela, Russia, all sorts of people are saying this is what the next currency will be. It's just not there yet.
Most of the ones who are particularly excited about it, at least at the nation state level, are playing for the other team, I think it's fair to say. Kevin Freeman, as always, we appreciate your insights into these incredibly interesting and increasingly dynamic economic warfare topics. We'll look forward to our visit with you again next week. In the meantime, thank you for what you're doing at globaleconomicwarfare.com and now increasingly at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. We'll look forward to what I understand is a rollout of that important initiative next week. Bless you. Next up, Rick Manning joins us. We'll talk with him about his starring role in the new Project Veritas blockbuster video and get his take on the Kavanaugh travesty. What's being done to a very good man is simply outrageous. That and more straight after this.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is my delight to tell you we are joined by the president of a terrific organization in the Washington area, Americans for Limited Government. His name is Richard Manning. He formerly served as a public affairs chief in the Department of Labor during the George W. Bush administration. One of the close encounters with the deep state that he has been working against ever since. He also served as a state lobbyist for the National Rifle Association. You can find Rick Manning's articles frequently in places like The Hill, Investor's Business Daily, Fox News, and elsewhere. He is a good friend and always a welcome guest. Rick, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Well, I wanted to commend you. We have not yet had a chance to visit with James O'Keefe, who is the driving force behind Project Veritas. But you feature prominently in their new video, and so let me commend him through you. Well done. It's a very important treatment. I gather not the only one in a forthcoming series, but the first, addressing this phenomenon of the deep state. Tell us a little bit about the most important insights, as you see it, that the film brought forward?
Well, first of all, I really commend people to go and see it. They can glimpse it at my website, which is dailytorch.org or dailytorch.com. You can get it there or go to Project Veritas's website, and they would have it as well. But here's the key. These are not high-level officials. These are relatively mid-level and low-level officials, young, and they are aggressively using government resources to promote the democratic socialist agenda in America. They are slow-walking Trump agenda priorities. They are I think what we're going to see when the public gets a look at the entirety of these videos, they are going to be shocked that there is such an organized internal activity designed to effectively end the United States.
Yeah. Well, as the film makes clear in a bit of narration by James O'Keefe, a lot of people were sort of discounting the reality of people inside the executive branch of the United States government who are actively working to subvert President Trump, the elected president of the United States, and his policies. The anonymous op-ed that appeared in the New York Times recently sort of gave lie to the fact that this isn't a real problem. And this particular video involves extensive conversations with a State Department employee who seems to be boasting about the fact that he is working on the Democratic Socialists of America's program on taxpayer underwritten time. This really conjures up an image of a problem that you've been working on assiduously for some time now, Rick Manning. You call it the Fire the Swamp campaign and a piece of legislation called the Merit Act. Talk about how these initiatives are needed correctives to a problem that the Project Veritas film exposes.
Sure. It's pretty obvious that you can't drain the swamp unless you can fire the swamp. And so we started an effort to focus on trying to streamline the civil service system for firing people in a way that makes sense. The Congress passed legislation, Donald Trump signed it, dealing with the VA.
That's, of course, the Veterans Administration, which is a huge bureaucracy.
Exactly right. In the wake of the Veterans Administration choosing to let veterans die rather than actually give them treatment, even the Democrats came on board for streamlining the firing process. And we've seen 26% increase in firings of civil service in the Veterans Administration since that was passed last year. So what we're trying to do is apply that same language to the rest of the federal government. Here's the absolute amazing fact. Less than 0.5% of all federal employees are fired in a given year, terminated for cause. And in terms of people who are laid off or fired, it's about 2.67% last year. That's fully 6.4% or 6.4 times lower layoff and firing rate than the private sector has. And so we're looking at a system where it is virtually impossible to fire a federal employee. If we don't change the civil service system, which is ultimately broken, we will not be able to root out the people who Mr. O'Keefe was able to identify in these videos. And what's more, it's intentional, because President Obama in 2010 changed the rules for hiring in the civil service. And rather than going through a really difficult process to be hired, he made it very easy. It's just send your resume in, and the political hiring authority can then hire you, totally usurping the old process that was very cumbersome, but it had a purpose of making certain that the civil service wasn't overtly politicized. It is now completely politicized, and that was the intent. The only way we can root out these political actors within the civil service is to be allowed to fire them in an expedited fashion. If they're lazy, if they're incompetent, or if they're resisting, they have no business being in the federal civil service, and they need to be fired.
And it was one of the high points of this video with James O'Keefe's interview with this State Department employee that he gloated about the fact that he couldn't be fired. So it really speaks to your point. And Rick, I did want to talk about the Merit Act, but I think we're going to do that on another occasion because I know this is a piece of legislation that's designed to try to provide a similar kind of, you know, latitude to people beyond the VA. But quickly, I want to get your thoughts on what's happening to Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court. This seems to me to be a travesty, but I'd love your expert opinion on the subject.
Well, it's pretty clear that Dianne Feinstein sat on the information until it couldn't be refuted in timely fashion to try to put a delay into the system of his confirmation. The Democrats failed to lay a glove on him during the confirmation hearing, so she pulled this rabbit out of her hat that she had in her hand in July, and chose not to confront the appointee Kavanaugh when he was sitting in front of her for 4 days.
Or even in private conversation with him.
She instead waited until it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that he was going to be confirmed, and then she pulls it out in a contrived effort to try to create a firestorm, which she succeeded. And so here we have somebody who's disingenuous at their core, Dianne Feinstein. And none of us know what happened when this guy was in high school, but that's the reason you have statutes of limitations. That's why you have, a vetting process. And this person should have been brought forward early if this was a real concern. The fact Dianne Feinstein waited till the end is the absolute most callous calculation you can imagine, because if the accuser did not want to be made public, the way Dianne Feinstein handled it guaranteed that she would be. And so Dianne Feinstein outed this person who may or may not have been a victim. But I look at it as one of those callous political calculations I've ever seen. And the fact is, I don't know who, given the fact that something you might allege happened when you were in elementary school, apparently is fair game. I don't know who's going to ever want to go through the confirmation process, given that the rules now are there are no rules. You don't have to have facts or be civil. I don't know who's going to go through this process in the future, Frank.
Well, it does raise that concern to me too, Rick. And I just hope that the basic fairness of the American people and their understanding of the fact that this individual, Brett Kavanaugh, strikes me as an exemplary American, means that what's being done here is not only unfair and, as you say, callous or cynical in the extreme, but it really is a miscarriage of justice. And I hope at the end of the day, he will be confirmed by the United States Senate and will serve with the distinction we all expect of him. Rick Manning, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate so much your time, your insights, the incredibly important work you do at Americans for Limited Government, and for visiting with us from time to time. I hope you'll do it again soon. I hope the rest of you will do it again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.